From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. On this special edition of the program, guest host Tatiana Voroshko, senior editor in VOA's Ukrainian service, reprises a conversation with renowned historian, author, and staff writer for The Atlantic magazine, Anne Applebaum, who just returned from Kyiv. Listeners may recall that we featured Tatiana's interview with Anne Applebaum exactly 1 year ago when she returned from Ukraine, not long after Russia launched a full-scale invasion of that sovereign country. At one point in the conversation, Tatiana asks Anne about the Holodomor, which in Ukrainian refers to the famine of 1930 to 1933, which affected the major grain-producing areas of Ukraine when it was part of the former Soviet Empire. I am pleased to present my colleague, Tatiana Voroshko.
The last time we talked, it was a little bit more than a year ago, and you just came back from your trip to Ukraine, first time since a full-scale invasion. And now you came from Ukraine again. You met the same people. You met President Zelensky. You met his cabinet. What struck you the most in terms of mood or circumstances of message between those two trips?
Oh, it's a completely different feeling now to be in Kyiv, as I'm sure you know. The first time we went was in April 2022, just after the Russians had left the north the city, and everything was still very provisional. There was still the sense of disorganization. People were still getting used to a new situation. You know, when we met the President Zelensky, it was in a dark building at night. There was a blackout, and again, the sense of emergency. And really, Kyiv doesn't feel like that at all now. I mean, there is, of course, still air raid sirens. You know, lots of evidence of the war, but there's traffic and there are open restaurants and people have come back. And you really feel people, it's not a question of getting used to the war, but learning how to cope with it, overcoming it, and being ready to keep going. I have a Ukrainian friend who I talked to over the winter at that really very bad moment when the electricity was uneven. And she said to me, you know, before the war, if you'd told me I would have no internet and I would have, you know, electricity only 3 hours a day and there would be problems with water, I would say, oh my God, I wouldn't be able to live like that. And now it turns out I can. And so I think also now people having got through the particularly difficult moment, people are feeling a little bit better about being in the city.
But about the Zelensky, about his cabinet, about the messaging they're trying to send to the world, did it change?
So they're also, it's not that it's more professional, it's that they're very clear now about what they need. I actually think that both the defense minister and the foreign minister have become really skilled diplomats. They're good at speaking to Western audiences. They're good at transmitting what they want. And so I know there were a lot of doubts at the beginning of the war about was this group of people really ready for this kind of challenge. And I think certainly the security and diplomacy parts of the Zelensky administration have begun to function very well.
One of the biggest kind of expectations right now and the biggest talk is spring counteroffensive. U.S. and Great Britain right now, the leadership are trying to a little bit downplay the expectations, saying that we will support Ukraine no matter how successful the counteroffensive is. But realistically, how much is, in terms of political support, in terms of support of people around the world, depends on the success of this counteroffensive?
It's not so much the success of particular battles. It's more that people are waiting to see what's possible. Are the Ukrainians able to take back enough territory to make a difference? Are they able to at least scare the Russians about their control of Crimea? Because I think that will then affect, it's not so much that it will affect aid, but it will affect people's perceptions of the war. So a war that might end this year is very different from a war that's going to last for another 10 years. In the United States, there's a particular problem, which is the problem of the 2024 election. And it now looks as if the Republican candidate will be Donald Trump. I mean, maybe I'm wrong and maybe something else will happen and that will turn out not to be true. But it could very well be him. And although he speaks for a minority of Americans when he says that he doesn't back Ukraine, which he's essentially said several times, he's still very influential on that group. And of course, if he were president, that would be the U.S. policy. And so some of this is dictated by worries about what happens if the war goes on to another year.
He says he can solve the problem in 24 hours.
Sorry?
He said that he can solve the problems, he can end the war in 24 hours.
I don't know what that means. I mean, he lies about everything and he makes up stories and it means nothing.
He explained that he can put both sides at the negotiation table, kind of setting this aside. This possible success of counteroffensive, can it lead to the situation when the West will say, okay, Ukraine, you are now in a good negotiating position, right? So you got some territories, so Russia is weaker. Start negotiating now. Can it put pressure on Ukraine to come to some agreement?
They could do that. I mean, I don't want to speculate because, I mean, this really is a war whose political outcome will be determined by the military victories or losses. And, you know, Ukraine really will be in a different position if it takes back, for example, even just the territory in the south. That's a different conversation from Ukraine that can't. You know, I don't know how to put it more subtly than that, but that will determine what people think is possible.
In one of your pieces, I think we talked also about this last time, to try to understand the cruelty, why Russian soldiers treat Ukrainian population with so much cruelty. In one of your pieces, which you did as part of the Reckoning projects, you kind of found this answer. Can you tell us about it?
So this was a piece I wrote, as you say, with a group of Ukrainian journalists. It's run by Natalia Guminyuk, who's herself a real star, I think, in Ukraine. And what they had done was interview people who had been in occupied territory and recently liberated territory in Ukraine in an attempt to understand the nature of that occupation. And one of the things that's clear about it is this unbelievable cruelty came partly from the Russian soldiers' sense of loss of control. So they couldn't understand the society that they were in. Everything that they'd been told about it wasn't true. They'd been told, you know, Ukraine doesn't exist. You know, there's just a little tiny group of leaders, and once you get rid of them, then everybody will be happier there. And then that wasn't true. And so they arrived in this very hostile places where people fought back against them. There were resistance movements. There was hostility. And they reacted with this extreme forms of brutality, you know, this arrest, beatings, murder, torture. And I think all of that was their confusion. They couldn't understand where they were. They couldn't understand how people were behaving. None of it made sense to them. I mean, what was interesting to me was the degree to which they focused on two particular groups of people. One were locally elected leaders, so mayors, city councilors, and another was volunteer leaders, so people who ran civic organizations and movements. And both of these categories of people were people that the Russians couldn't understand. So the idea that there's a local mayor, and he's really the mayor. He was elected by, you know, by the public, and he's genuinely popular, and he has responsibilities to the city or the village, and people respect him. This is something they don't know, because they don't have real politicians. They don't have elected politicians. They would have somebody who was appointed, or somebody who was corrupt, or not somebody who was an authentic democratic leader. And so they found those people very confusing, and they arrested them. I mean, almost, I think most, I don't remember the statistics now, but a majority of city and village leaders in occupied Kherson province have been arrested or have disappeared. City councilors, people who worked for the city administration, civil servants, many of them have, again, arrested, beaten, disappeared, sometimes murdered. And the second group, as I said, is volunteers. So people who spontaneously organized attempts to get food to elderly people, or in some cases when the police disappeared after the occupation, people set up nighttime patrols so that people would feel safe. And the Russians could not understand this. There's one interview I know that we used in the article we wrote with a leader of a volunteer group in a former occupied territory who said, you know, the Russians kept asking me, you know, why are you doing this? Who's organizing? And he said, no one's organizing. You know, I'm the leader. I decide. And that, where's your money coming from? Well, I go around and I ask people for money and they give it to me. And why are you doing it? Because I want to help people. And this was completely incomprehensible to them. They couldn't understand it at all. And again, their reaction was this brutal reaction of people for whom this was, you know, really genuinely foreign country. And so I think this culture clash is what helps to explain this brutality.
Can you also explain the reason for the war, the culture clash and imperialist, you know, Russia's empire?
The reason for the war is, again, Putin's belief that Ukraine is not a real country. And then when they encountered real Ukrainians fighting back against them, this desire to eradicate them. I mean, this is, in that sense, become a genocidal war. The purpose is to eradicate Ukrainian culture, Ukrainian government, Ukrainian, anybody who speaks the Ukrainian language. There's been, as you know, pressure on schools and universities to switch from Ukrainian to Russian or to drop Ukrainian language books, Ukrainian history. I think now the purpose of the war is, I mean, it's more than just imperial. It's about eradicating what there is of Ukraine.
Ukrainians were trying for years and centuries to tell the world that we are not Russians, we are different. And it's only now the world can see, understand that they're different people.
Well, the war has also clarified a lot of things. I mean, I think even for people in the region. I mean, you know, look, Ukraine and Russia were closely linked for many years, and they were part of the same empires, and, you know, there's a lot of cross-marriage, and all of that could be good. I mean, you know, the United States and Canada also are very close, and there's cross-marriage, and Canadians move to the United States, and, you know, Americans move to Canada, and it doesn't mean that much. And, you know, once you could imagine with a different kind of leadership and a different kind of political culture, you could imagine that relationship between Russia and Ukraine, right? You have some shared history and shared literature and so on. But unfortunately, with the current leadership of Russia, it's become impossible. It's as if America said Canada shouldn't exist, and so we want to destroy all Canadians and all evidence of Canadian culture. I mean, that would immediately erase any normal kind of relationship.
How important it is to recognize what's going on in Ukraine as genocide in as many official as much as possible, to name it and then to persecute as genocide?
So I slightly worry about the term genocide, that it's overused, and I'm more interested in pursuing Russia for specific war crimes where proof can be produced, and it's not about establishing a theory, it's about establishing what happened. That doesn't mean that I don't believe that's what it is, but I thought, for example, the International Criminal Court's decision to indict Putin for the deportation of Ukrainian children was excellent because it's a specific crime. People can understand it. It is, of course, genocidal. I mean, the purpose of making Ukrainian children into Russians has that purpose, but the court used the language of kidnapping and breaking the law. And this is something that people find easy to understand. And I'm hoping that eventually there will be clear crimes attached to particular people, you know, with names and dates and so on. I mean, this is the Reckoning Project is one of a number of projects that are already now seeking to establish what exactly happened and why. And I think that's the road that I hope Ukrainian prosecutors go down. And I think at the end of that process, people will say, right, we understand that it was genocide, but we need to establish exactly what happened.
What about Russian people? How much responsibility do they bear, those who support the war?
They bear responsibility in the sense that all nations have responsibility for what's done in their name. That doesn't mean that every single Russian is genocidal or that every single Russian wants this war. I don't believe that. But, you know, the Russians who I know who are most bitterly against the war still feel responsible for it. So yes, of course, as a country, they bear responsibility for it.
What about the West in terms of, like, as a historian, how much do you see the role of Holodomor historically here and the fact that Russia never, Moscow never, nobody was held responsible for Holodomor? It's one of the genocides Ukrainian people, and now it's repeating.
You know, it's not just the Holodomor. It goes back, there are other incidents over many years. But yes, I think Russia's failure to understand the history of Ukraine and to understand what was done to Ukraine in the past, to understand the Holodomor, to understand even, you know, the 19th century attempts to, you know, eradicate the Ukrainian land, destroy Ukrainian theaters and stop Ukrainian books from being printed. The history of Russia and repression of Ukraine is, of course, not known in Russia. And that is a part of why the Russians have so badly misunderstood Ukraine. You know, I'm very struck by the fact that Putin has so little understanding of Ukraine, and he's somebody who is actually interested in history. I mean, he produced these extraordinary, almost ridiculous articles and lectures about Ukraine and Ukrainian history that seemed to have been, I don't know where they came from or who gave him the information, but he was very badly informed. And I think bad history has helped create this war.
Do you think that justice can be negotiable? Like, for example, if there's a peace agreement, can the justice be negotiable?
I'm not sure what you mean by that. I mean, whether anybody wants it or not, there will be a continued push for justice after this war that will go on for the rest of our lives. So there will be attempts to document what happened, demands for reparations. You know, everybody who lives in Ukraine now will remember what happened and will continually seek to hold Russia responsible. So I think the question of what is justice and what it means will evolve over time. There may be different kinds of answers. Some of it may be international courts. Some of it may be, as I said, reparations. Some of it may be eventually public apologies. I don't know. But this is just the beginning of that conversation, and it will go on for many years.
You are listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. VOA colleague Tatiana Voroshko is speaking with historian Anne Applebaum, who recently returned from Kyiv. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. And this is a reminder to tune into our sister program, Encounter. This weekend, we analyze the preliminary results of the landmark Turkish presidential elections with author and senior fellow at the Cato Institute, Mustafa Akyol, and Merve Tahiroğlu, Turkey Program Director at the Project on Middle East Democracy. You don't want to miss this insightful conversation. We will have them back at the microphones after the May 28 runoff to discuss the victor, whether incumbent President Recep Tayyip Erdogan or CHP candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, to understand the domestic, regional, and global implications for Turkey. Now back to Tatiana's interview with writer and historian Anne Applebaum.
Could the full victory of Ukraine, defeat of Russia, be good for Russian people to let them process their present, their past, and reckon with what they did and start with
healthy? I believe very deeply that, yes, a Ukrainian victory could save Russia. I mean, literally save Russia. So Russia is a country that is living off an imperial idea that is deadly for Russians. Think how many Russians have died unnecessarily in this war. Think of the blood and treasure that have been spent on this war and on other wars, on, you know, the wars in Chechnya, in Georgia, in Syria. Think about the misuse of resources in Russia, you know, the amount of money and power accrued by people in Moscow in the name of empire and in the name of making Russia great. And think how terrible that's been for ordinary Russians. You know, I think, yes, of course, defeat would offer Russia a chance to, including ordinary Russians, the chance to ask, is this the kind of country that we want to live in? That would be the best outcome of this war.
If we talk a little bit about how it's viewed from outside of Russia, outside of Ukraine, the most recent Pew Research poll said that about one-third of Americans, 34%, have, most of the people have positive view of Ukraine, but 34% have negative view, so which struck me. So this is a country fighting for its own survival. Why almost one-third of Americans view it negatively? Is it that many watch Russian propaganda?
It's not just Russian propaganda. American far-right and far-left propaganda are also focused on supporting Russia and attacking Ukraine. There are a number of very prominent and important American politicians, number one being Donald Trump, who are openly and quite aggressively anti-Ukrainian, and they're, you know, they influence people, unfortunately. I mean, one of the other odd things is that support for Ukraine in America goes up when the Ukrainians seem to be winning, and then it sometimes goes down or becomes weaker when people are less clear about the outcome. So it's also some strange psychology. And then finally, I would say America is now a very polarized, very partisan country where people have very opposite views. And the fact that Biden is president and Biden is supporting Ukraine means almost by definition that some percentage of Americans don't. So, I mean, I think that's maybe more important than even than Russian propaganda.
And we can also see that young Americans are the ones who think that the country should more focus on its own internal issues and not to deal with international conflicts, not to intervene. So should Europe, also in light of the elections, be prepared to lead without the United States? Should they be ready for United States be unreliable, uninterested partner in the future?
So Europe should do that, but I see no prospect of that happening fast enough. For Europe to become a real player in defense and in strategy would require an enormous investment that nobody has made yet. My husband is a Polish politician, has been talking about this for a decade. I've read so many articles describing what could be, and you could have a European army and you could have European strategy. But I don't see yet this willpower in Europe to make it happen. Even if there were such a thing, even if there were a decision tomorrow, it would still take many years for it to be real. I mean, I think one of the really important things we've learned from this war, I mean, one of the things we learned is that the Russian army wasn't as good as we expected. But another thing we've learned is that the United States is still this indispensable partner. What U.S. is capable of in terms of weapons, ammunition, but also intelligence is so far ahead of what Europe can do that, unfortunately, it would take a long time to catch up.
You also mentioned the argument on the left, and it's very prevalent in Latin America. For example, the Brazilian president even said that the West should stop pouring weapons in Ukraine because it's only prolonged the conflict. And for me, it's like, it's not that hard to understand that if a smaller victim needs to defend itself from the big aggressors, it needs tools. So what's going on the left? Why are they using this argument? And what is going on morally and intellectually?
What's going on is you're hearing decades of suspicion of the United States is what you're actually hearing. And the feeling in Latin America that, you know, inability to believe that Russia started the war, somehow America must be to blame. America must be to blame for continuing the war. It's a focus on the United States and a real lack of knowledge about Russia and Ukraine. Ukraine has not actually been very active in diplomacy in Latin America over the last 30 years. It's not a country that many Latin American leaders know well. So I think it's a combination of ignorance and, as I said, this kind of focus on America as the source of where if something's going bad in the world, it must be America's fault.
The other popular belief, both in Latin America and in Africa, kind of equating Russia with the Soviet Union without understanding that probably those doctors who were treating you might have as well be Ukrainians. And it seems like Ukraine almost ceding the past and the legacy, some of the good legacy of the Soviet Union. What can it do about that? How can it explain it? Yes, there was our soldiers, there was our doctors, there was our pilots. And should it do it?
I mean, I'm not sure that it's worth it now to try and reclaim the Soviet legacy, because I think it's not really about a specific memory of Soviet help. It's more, as I said, this idea that America and the Western world are the source of whatever is evil and negative. I think that's more important than a specific links to the Soviet Union. I mean, the Soviet Union has been gone for 30 years. And so anybody who remembers it now is very old. So this is more of a theoretical idea rather than a real idea.
And why would the West, it seems to be charmed by Russia over and over again. So it's like the, you know, rebooting relationship. Didn't Russia do enough?
Sorry, I didn't understand the question.
It seems to be like the West is being charmed by Russia.
Charmed
by Russia over and over again. And the Ukrainians just worried that...
It's not charm. It's certainly until this war. The problem was that for really the last two or three decades, Russia has simply not been anybody's priority. So when the Cold War ended, quite a lot of Western leaders said, well, that's a great relief. Now we can think about something else. We want to think about the Middle East, or we want to think about China, or we want to put our focus somewhere else. And, you know, there was one moment when there were no American tanks left in Europe. You know, we brought home so much equipment and so many soldiers, there was almost nothing there. And that was a relief to people. And there was this sense that thinking about Russia or worrying about Russia was something old people did who were looking backwards, you know. It was a silly obsession of people, old cold warriors. It was more that. I didn't think anybody was particularly charmed by Russia. It was more that we didn't want to worry about it. And people who talked about Russia were sometimes laughed at or dismissed. I have a British friend who wrote a book called The New Cold War, and it's published 15 years ago now. And when that came out, you know, people mocked him, you know. Oh, you're just an old cold warrior. You want to go back to the cold, you know. And all he was doing was presenting the facts. And so I think, you know, that and then, of course, combined with the desire to do business with Russia, a lot of European prosperity over the last not just 30 years, but 50 years has been based on relatively cheap supplies of natural gas from Russia. So those things combined to give people an incentive to overlook what happens. I do think something has changed now. I think the war was a great shock to people. I think the sight of tanks rolling across the countryside and the refugees at the train stations, I think that made a big impression on people, particularly in Germany, but also in France and Britain. And I didn't foresee returning to some kind of previous status quo.
I have to say there were plenty of people in Ukraine who laughed off Russian threat. For decades.
Of course.
Yeah.
So. Of course. I mean, there were people in Ukraine in December 2021 when I was there who didn't believe in the Russian threat either. So.
You say the opinion and the changes. So one of the basic premise that if as soon as the country become more prosperous, more democratic, it becomes less aggressive and, you know, it becomes a contributing member of the West. What happened with Poland? What happened to Ukraine? What happened to other Eastern European countries? It did not happen to Russia. Russia, as it became more prosperous, it becomes only more dangerous. So should the West rethink this premise and maybe not to invest, not to help, you know, not make those countries richer?
So this is a very big question, and of course it affects not just Russia but also China. And right now you're watching in Washington this argument being hashed out. So yes, it was true in the 1990s. The assumption was that trade and good diplomatic relations with autocracies would not necessarily make them democracies. I don't think people thought like that. It wasn't not quite that naive, but would at least make them friendlier, and it would make it more difficult for them to go to war with us because there would be mutual interest, because there would be trade, and people would have an interest in not having a conflict. And this belief was based on experience. I mean, actually, the German experience trading with Russia in the 1980s, it was based on, as you say, the successful absorption of Central Europe into Europe in the 1990s and 2000s. And of course, actually, it's based on a deeper European experience already from the 1940s and 50s. If we create a trading organization, we won't fight each other anymore. So it had a logical basis, and that was why I think it was so deep. It is now clear that in certain kinds of countries, especially countries where there is an elite that is able to manipulate the economy in such a way that the benefits of the trade mostly go to them, and where you have companies that are really looking to trade with America and Europe in order to steal their patents and ideas and so on, which is one of the charges against China, then there may be more problems with trade than there are benefits. And right now you're watching a kind of turn happen. And of course, it's already happened with Russia. I mean, there's, trade with Russia has ended. I mean, there's very little that's left. And you're now watching in Washington the same argument unfolding about China. And I don't know where it will end. China's more difficult because it's a much bigger economy. It's much more important to America than Russia ever was.
Are there any big lessons from this war? How would it change global?
I think the lesson is the one we're discussing right now, which is that trade with autocracies might reinforce autocracy. And we need to think about whether we want to do that.
What are the big lessons from this war for the West, for the Western democracies?
Maybe the biggest lesson is to understand and to stop the aggression of autocracies before it moves too far. I think Russia could have been stopped in 2014.
Just one question. I feel sorry because I see how tired you are. How do you think this war might end?
The real end to the war, I mean, meaning it's not just a ceasefire, it's not just temporary, it's not just, for a few months. The real end of the war happens when there is a political change in Moscow. And that doesn't necessarily mean regime change. And I don't even know if it means Putin has to leave. Some people disagree with me, but maybe it could even be under him. And this change is that the Russians understand that the war was a mistake and they withdraw their troops. And I know that sounds annoyingly vague. People usually, when they ask this question, they want me to say, well, it'll be in 2 months and it will look like this. And here's what the peace treaty will look like. I can't tell you any of that. I can tell you that there has to be a political shift, and it could be caused by a military defeat. It could be caused by infighting or arguments in Moscow. It could be caused by, just the sheer number of casualties as they build up and as people, wives and mothers and sisters and friends across Russia begin to protest. There just simply has to be a moment where there's a tipping point. And this is the, why did France withdraw from Algeria in 1962? It was because there was a shift like that. Why did the British leave Ireland, which is a strangely similar situation, neighboring country, same language, long history. Why did they leave Ireland? Same thing. It just wasn't worth it anymore. People didn't believe in the war. They didn't want to fight it anymore. And this kind of change needs to happen. And we could be quite close to it, or we could still be far away. But that's when it ends. And as I understand the thinking in Kyiv, this is how many people there think as well. So they understand that it's not just military victory they need. They also need to leave some kind of political mark. And that's some of what you're seeing now is an attempt to create that.
Thank you so much. I hope it happens sooner.
Thank you. Tatiana Voroshko, speaking with historian and staff writer for The Atlantic magazine, Anne Applebaum, who just returned from Kyiv. Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. And did you know that May 19th was International Endangered Species Day? Please join Rick Pantaleo for the science edition of Press Conference USA next week when he and his guests talk about the efforts that are being made to protect the world's endangered species. That's next week on the science edition of Press Conference USA, right here on The Voice of America.